Case number 12-5139. Rano S. Coach, appellant versus Mary Jo White in her capacity as chairman, United States Securities and Exchange et al. Mr. McClanahan for the appellant, Mr. Mayer for the appellees.
May it please the court, my name is Kel McClanahan and I'll be representing Randolph Koch today. I would like at the beginning to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal, if that's all right. This case, for all of its apparent complexity, is actually very simple. It boils down to three questions of law that, you know, any one of which could result in a remand and a reversal. The first question is a straight application of the circuit's ruling in Artis v. Bernanke. Can an agency dismiss a complaint for failure to exhaust remedies when the complainant has not completely frustrated the agency's ability to perform the investigation? Put more simply, was the EEO office and all of its subcontractors and subcontractors able to investigate Mr. Koch's complaint even without his cooperation at the late stage in the investigation when he stopped cooperating? The second point is a straight statutory interpretation, or rather regulatory interpretation.
You said that issue could be dispositive? Why could that issue be dispositive?
Because the district court dismissed this complaint for failure to cooperate. However, Mr. Koch did not failed to cooperate in such a way that it completely frustrated the agency's ability to conduct the investigation. He gave his medical records to the EEO counselor, something which, by the way, the agency...
To the counselor, but not the investigator.
Yes, he did, actually. That's in the supplemental part that we're seeking to supplement the appendix with, and which the agency has actually admitted that its key witness, Anik Shah, had misstated in the declaration relied upon by the district court. The EE investigator, Audrey Weintraub, did have a copy of those medical records. They were submitted to her directly by Mr. Koch, as well as to, The counselor, Audrey Weintraub, was given...
That's not the question I asked you. I asked you whether the investigator, who was the contract investigator, had the medical records.
I thought
plaintiff's whole position was that he didn't want the investigator to have the documents because there weren't sufficient privacy protections.
I do not know if he was given the records.
Isn't that what that case is all about?
Pardon me?
Isn't that what this case is about? If the investigator has all the medical records, why are we here? I don't understand this.
The investigator had access to the medical records.
What does that mean?
Pardon me?
What does that mean?
That means that by the SEC's own agreement, Daniel Jewell, the investigator, would be allowed to look at the medical records in an SEC facility.
Client objected to him looking at it, and as a result of that, he didn't.
And also, didn't the SEC, in an effort to settle this, say, look, we won't give it to the contractor, but if he needs it, then we'll consult you first. Is that not true?
That is partially accurate.
Partially?
It is unclear because at the point that the SEC said that, Mr. Koch declined to continue cooperation with the investigation until an appropriate contract was drawn up that had the Privacy Act clauses in it, which, as an aside, this one did, although no one knew that on either side. And the agency cut off the investigation. We actually don't know what would have happened had they continued their investigation, because
Ask you one fact question?
Sure.
Okay. I don't have the date in front of me, but I thought that at the last, in order to get this thing going, Shaw agreed to withhold releasing the medical records to the contractor. He agreed to do that and said, we won't give him the medical records, and if he needs them, we will consult the plaintiff first. Is that true or false?
Referring to the Mr. Shah's declaration, it is true that no medical records were requested, disclosed, or transferred from any source.
Wait, forget his declaration.
Okay.
I now found my notes. August 2, 2008, there's an email.
Right.
Okay? In an effort to move this along, this is from Shaw to your client. In an effort to move this along, we will maintain any medical records in our office. We will not provide them to Jewel. If we determine that disclosure becomes necessary, we will notify you in advance. Joint Appendix 92.
Oh, 92. Sorry.
Yeah. Now, what about that?
Oh, from August 7th.
7th.
Sorry. That's right. Did
I use the wrong date? SARS, what did I say?
We will notify you in advance.
That's what I said, August 2. So, well, doesn't this suggest that the investigator, Mr. Jewel, did not have the medical records?
According to this, the investigator did not have the medical records. However, he could have had the medical records for two reasons. The first reason is very simple. This was a self-inflicted wound on the part of the SEC. When Mr. Koch stopped talking to Mr. Jewel, the SEC was still able to give him the records by law, by the Privacy Act routine use that applied to the records, and it voluntarily limited itself in its ability to do so. When he stopped cooperating,
at your client's behest.
Right.
Pardon me?
At your client's behest. In other words, you say it's voluntary, and I take it in some physical sense it was voluntary, but the reason they decided not to turn over the medical records is because your client specifically raised that as his main privacy concern. And so they acceded to your client's request not to turn over the medical records.
Yes and no. They acceded to something that my client did not ask for. My client, as evidence from the record, when they said that, still said, that is not enough. And so, oh, sorry, I thought that was a red light. And so they still, and that's why he stopped cooperating and stopped talking to Mr. Jewel. They could have at any point still notified him in advance. They chose not to. And that's the point I'm making is when he said, I'm not going to talk to Mr. Jewel anymore and give him any more information than he already has, unless you put a contract in place that has the appropriate Privacy Act clauses in it, they said, okay, and dismissed the case, which is the entire point of Artis that we are making, is that they did not have that right. His ability, Mr. Jewel's and the SEC's ability to investigate this complaint was not completely frustrated. They had the medical records. Mr. Shah has even gone on record saying, we did not have any medical records, and then the SEC walked that back and said, actually, that was a mistake. We did have the medical records, and then a month later said, and as Mr. Shah said, we did not have any medical records.
Well, so they had, in other words, they had the medical records in some sense, but they weren't allowed by your client's request to give the medical records to the person who could do something with them. And but yet you're saying that even though your client specifically asked to have the medical records withheld from Jewel, that what the SEC should have done is given them to him anyway. Is that basically what you're saying?
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
I'm saying that the SEC was not legally forbidden from giving the records to Mr. Jewel, regardless of what my client believed. That they agreed not to still does not change the fact that they were not completely frustrated. Because they could have given to them anyway.
Can I ask you this question about that, which is that the medical records are one issue, and we've been focused on that. But what the email points to, the email that Judge Tatel was reading from earlier, points to in addition is testimony. And the SEC specifically told your client, we'll withhold the medical records at your request because you've asked us to, but we need your testimony. And it seems to me that testimony is a pretty important part of an investigation because you have to get the person's story from them in conditions in which their veracity can be tested. But there was no opportunity to get testimony because at that point your client just stopped. Is that correct?
That is not entirely correct, Your Honor.
So did he offer to testify?
There was ample evidence already of his arguments. He had been in counseling for 4 months.
You're not answering Judge Schumann's question.
He did not testify to Mr. Jewell, no.
Right.
What he did do was say, I will testify, I will give you everything you want, if you can address my concerns about the Privacy Act clauses, and they said no. And
by the way,
which is worse, may I?
Yeah, finish. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Which is worse because in hindsight, when I came on the case long after all of the administrative procedure, when I found out that the protections were actually there, all Mr. Shaw had to do was say, yes, they're there. They're nested, but they're there. He didn't even try, despite multiple attempts. This was a case that could have been resolved well before it got to litigation by Mr. Shaw doing his due diligence and not misleading and implying that the Privacy Act protections that Mr. Koch was insisting on were not there when, in fact, they were.
One thing I don't understand about your argument on this point is the following, that what is it that's so significant about these particular two clauses? Because the contract on its face says that the personnel are bound by the Privacy Act. So the Privacy Act does apply. So there must have been something significant about these two clauses that caused him to refrain from cooperating. What is it about those? Is there something additional that we should take into account that they provide him by way of protection? Because the Privacy Act already applies on the face of the contract.
It's not the clauses themselves so much as the context. For instance, Mr. Jewell had told my client, Mr. Koch, that there were no such clauses of any kind in his subcontract. You must remember, he was not the prime contractor. And that was the first thing that drew my client's concern. The second thing was, for good or for ill, my client is a bit of a detail-oriented lawyer. That was his training. That was what came up. And when he saw that these clauses, which were specifically required, were not there, he began to ask, is there something I'm missing that they're not there because they should be? And so he was, you could say, over-worried about it or just the right amount of worried about it. It doesn't change the legal fact that regardless of his motivations, the contract clauses were argued, or implied at least, not to be there, and he did not know why, and he could not get a straight answer from Mr. Shaw as to why.
Did the non-disclosure agreement cover Jewell?
It is unclear, Your Honor. We don't have any information from the subcontract between Jewell and DSCA.
Well, if it did, what is inadequate about the privacy protections in there?
To answer your question, we must first assume that the clauses were actually not present as we thought they were not.
But wait, didn't the non-disclosure agreement say that it barred any disclosure of non-public information to anyone outside the firm? Isn't that what it said? I'm just talking about the language of the non-disclosure agreement itself.
Right. And I'm saying,
didn't it bar any disclosure to any of non-public information at all?
It's clearly possible to read that as doing so. Mm-hmm. I think our argument is this is a straight up statutory regulatory language. When the argument of when the FAR says shall, it means shall. And regardless of whether or not the non-disclosure agreement actually did provide these protections is okay. A red herring. It's okay. It's irrelevant to the question of whether or not that was still appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Peter Mayer, Counsel for the United States Government, here the Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commission itself. The Court's questions reflect the fact that it is familiar with the record and the issues in this case. I'd like to address four points with respect to that record that the Court discussed with opposing counsel in his presentation a moment ago. The first point concerns whether the SEC had at its disposal the ability to obtain all the medical records that it needed in this matter. That's not quite right. After all, in the complaint itself, the plaintiff alleged that the mere acquisition of some medical records by the SEC's EEO counselor in Boston itself was a violation of the Privacy Act. So clearly, any further transmission at the SEC's behest of those medical records that it had collected initially in Boston onto the SEC would also have to be a violation of the Privacy Act. And you'll find that discussed at page 47 of the record. The second point is the assertion that plaintiff's counsel made that there was a limited cooperation by Mr. Koch with respect to this investigation. Basically, he claimed that he'd given all his medical records, he just didn't want to present them a second time. Well, that's not quite right. The agency needed additional medical records. They didn't collect everything that it needed at the first blush in Boston. And as the Court's questions indicated, the SEC's hired investigator at DSZA didn't have anything. But the more pertinent point is the plaintiff didn't simply object to providing a certain number of records. He said he wouldn't cooperate at all. If you look at page JA-12 of the Joint Appendix, you'll see the amended complaint, and it explains the rather Shermanesque statement that the plaintiff made when he didn't get what he wanted in terms of inclusion of Part 24. He states, when the SEC did not cooperate, that is, promised to include Part 24, he exercised his only remaining option to not participate in the investigation. I repeat, to not participate in the investigation. This was not a refusal to provide a few medical records for a second time. The third point that I want to address is plaintiff's assertion this morning that this all could have been avoided if only the SEC's person involved, Anit Shah, had explained what was in and what was not in the DSCA contract with respect to nondisclosure. But Shah did exactly that, and you'll see that discussed at page 47 of the Joint Appendix. And at that point, or it's page 38, the SEC explained to Koch why Part 24 was unnecessary, because all of the protections that he would have received under Part 24 were provided in other substantive provisions of the contract between the SEC and its contractor. So Shaw told plaintiff exactly why Part 24 was superfluous. There was no failure on the SEC's part to communicate.
Yeah, but I think his point is different. I'm not saying whether it's ultimately persuasive, but I think his point is not what you just alluded to, but is that if the SEC had told him that the Part 24 clauses, these particular clauses, in fact were incorporated into the contract, then everything would have been over.
I understand that point, but the plaintiff's position here has varied. At some points, Judge Srinivasan, the plaintiff asserted that the SEC and Shaw affirmatively told him Part 24 isn't there. But at other portions of the record, he admits that that's not quite the case. What the SEC told him was that it's superfluous. He says that the fact that the SEC told him it was superfluous is tantamount to saying it's not there. But we both know there's a difference in saying something's not mandatory and it's not there. And if you'll read the record in its entirety, you'll see that all the SEC said was it doesn't have to be there.
I understand what you're saying. I have to say, though, if I'm in someone's shoes and the government is telling me, if I'm saying, explain to me why the following provisions aren't there. And then the government responds to me, well, they don't have to be there. Then my assumption immediately is that they're not there.
That's fair, but there was no affirmative misrepresentation.
Right.
And I agree with the implication of your question. There's enough blame to go around here. The plaintiff could have discovered the fact that it was there. The SEC could have discovered the fact that it was there. But what the SEC said was true. That is, it was unnecessary because all the substantive protections that he would have gotten from Part 24 were provided elsewhere. That leads me to my fourth point. Plaintiff's counsel said that he was unaware of whether all these protections with respect to nondisclosure applied to the particular investigator, that is, Mr. Jewell. But if you look at page 47 of the joint appendix, you will see Mr. Jewell's signed nondisclosure statement in which he himself agrees to abide by all of the provisions with respect to nondisclosure. So there's no question that the SEC generally and that its particular investigator here had agreed to abide by the same substantive provisions that Mr. Koch asserted was needed in order to protect his privacy interests. Those are the only points with respect to the record that I thought needed clarification. I'm happy to answer any other questions if the court has any. Otherwise, we're prepared to submit the case to the court's disposition.
Thank you. Did Mr. McClellan have any time left? Okay, you can take a minute if you would like.
Okay, I'll make it very brief then, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Right.
To the point of the nondisclosure agreement, I will admit that I did misspeak there. That is something that I had forgotten about. I don't actually have a copy of that in the file that I brought with me today. However, nondisclosure agreements can be rescinded by anybody. The contractor, DSEA, could have released Mr. Jewell from this. We don't, and nothing would have happened. That aside, the fact that there was a nondisclosure agreement is not dispositive as to whether or not the contract had the required clauses. And all of the government's case and most of the government's case and most of Judge Friedman's ruling was based on the fact that if the FAR language was not required, was superfluous, then everything about this was unreasonable by Mr. Koch. And that's not the case. Even if you find that the FAR language was not required, Mr. Koch's belief that it was reasonable. It was supported by discussions with the GSA, who wrote the contract that this was based on. It was based on analysis. It was based on a reading of the FAR that said that anything that requires the operation of a system of records requires this language, and the OMB Privacy Act guidelines that say that operation means use. No one can argue that Mr. Jewell would not use the information that was in the SEC's files. And that's really the bottom line here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. Thank you both.